From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, John, Paul, George, and Pete. We talk with Pete Best. He was the Beatles drummer before Ringo. Best has written a book about the early days of the band in Liverpool and Hamburg. He also writes about the Casbah Coffee Club, a club his mother created in their basement, which became a showcase for Liverpool bands. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Against Love, a Polemic by Laura Kipnis. It's a witty critique of marriage and monogamy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A federal appeals court in California has thrown out about 100 death sentences in three western states because the condemned inmates were sent to death row by judges and not by juries. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that requiring juries to impose the death penalty should be applied retroactively in Arizona, Idaho, and Montana. Last year, the U.S. Supreme Court found that juries, not judges, must impose the death penalty. But the High Court did not rule on whether their decision should be applied to inmates sitting on death row. The appellate court's ruling applies to the three western states within its jurisdiction. Two other states, Nebraska and Colorado, allow judges to impose the death penalty, but those states are not covered by the Ninth Circuit's ruling. The decision was based on the 1982 conviction of a functionally retarded man who was sentenced to death by a judge who admittedly smoked marijuana. Richard Gonzalez, NPR News, San Francisco.
Iraqi Shia Muslims converged on the holy city of Najaf today for the funeral of Ayatollah Muhammad Bakr al-Hakim. The Shiite Muslim cleric and scores of others were killed in a car bombing at a mosque last Friday. Mourners in the funeral procession trekked 110 miles for 3 days from Baghdad to Najaf. BBC's reporter Valerie Jones was among the crowds lining the streets.
The coffin went past, carried on the back of a truck. The four-lane highway leading to the central mosque was packed. Thousands and thousands of people following the coffin and crowding round it, stretching out their hands and chanting of their sorrow for the Ayatollah. This is the last day of mourning for the Ayatollah, and the mood in Najaf is more somber and more calm. The day after the bomb went off, the crowds in this holy city had been angry, expressing their outrage and making accusations against anyone they felt could be responsible. But today, those I've spoken to have talked of wanting calm and peace for Iraq.
BBC reporter Valerie Jones in Najaf. The head of the UN's nuclear watchdog agency said today that Iran's nuclear program is a matter of concern. Speaking at a conference in Germany, Mohammed El-Baradei said Iran must prove that it's not trying to develop nuclear weapons.
The earlier we finish the job in Iran, the better for both Iran and the international community. We need to provide assurances that Iran is free from any nuclear weapon program, and that, I think, is something we take with utmost seriousness.
The Bush administration has been trying to get the International Atomic Energy Agency to declare Iran in breach of its obligations to the UN. Iran insists that its program is designed only to build nuclear power plants. In stocks today, the Dow gained 107 points, or 1.1%, to close at 9,523. The Nasdaq gained 31 points to close at 1,841. This is NPR News. South Dakota Congressman Bill Janklow has made his first court appearance to answer manslaughter and reckless driving charges. He's accused of causing a traffic collision that killed a motorcyclist. Kurt Nikic reports from South Dakota Public Radio.
Supporters lined the halls of the courthouse and cheered when Janklow entered the building. The 63-year-old Republican moved slowly up the courthouse stairs with one person on each arm to assist him. His unsteady appearance could be due to medication for a head injury from the accident. Janklow did not speak during the 5-minute hearing. One of his lawyers requested a preliminary hearing to determine whether there's enough evidence to go to trial. The judge set one for later this month. Investigators say the congressman was going 71 in a 55-mile-an-hour zone last month when he ran a stop sign and collided with a motorcycle, killing its rider. If convicted, Janklow could get up to 10 years in prison just on the manslaughter charge. For NPR News, I'm Kurt Nickisch in Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
The Securities and Exchange Commission wants to know how the New York Stock Exchange determined a pay package of nearly $140 million for its chairman, Richard Grasso. In a letter to the head of the exchange's compensation committee, the SEC requested full details on the pay package. The letter was signed by SEC Chairman William Donaldson, who wrote that approval of the package raised serious questions about the way the stock exchange is being governed. Grasso's compensation was made public last week when the exchange announced that it was extending his contract for 2 more years, paying him almost $140 million for what it said were accrued savings, benefits, and incentives. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, working to improve diabetes treatment in the U.S. For 80 years, diabetes care has been our passion, not just our business.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Before Ringo, the drummer with the Beatles was Pete Best. He explains how he joined the band and how he was forced out in his new book, The Beatles, The True Beginnings, which is written with his brothers, Rogue and Rory Best. Their mother, Mona Best, played an important part in the story. In 1959, she turned their basement into a club called the Casbah Corfe Club, so her son and the neighborhood bands would have a place to play. Those bands included the Quarrymen, the name the Beatles used to play under. Pete Best joined the band in 1960, just in time to go to Hamburg with them. There were 5 members then, including Stu Sutcliffe, the bass player who quit the band in 1961, a year before he died of a brain hemorrhage. Here's the Beatles, with Pete Best on drums, recorded in Germany in 1961, performing a song from the 20s, Ain't She Sweet. John Lennon is singing lead. Best, welcome to Fresh Air. Your mother opened the club in your basement, the Casbah, in August of 1959. Why did your mother want to open a club in your basement? Most mothers want their kids to play someplace else, as far away as possible.
Well, you've got to remember it was a big Victorian house set in about an acre of ground. And we had a lot of friends in those days who used to transpose themselves through the house. And she just thought it would be more relaxing for her to have us all in one place down below. And we were initially going to make it into a den, and then she came up with the great idea to actually turn it into a coffee club, because coffee bars were, I suppose you could turn around and say, the in thing in the 1950s. And once word was out that we were going to actually turn it into a club, we had people knocking at the door who wanted to be members, and consequently, you know, the club was on a roll. All she had to do was give it a name, and it was called the Casbah.
Would you describe what the Casbah looked like physically?
Let me see now. If you go to when it first opened up, there were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 rooms. The Quarrymen played in what we call the middle chamber, where the rainbow ceiling was. And as you went into the first entrance of the club, there was a large dragon on the wall, which was painted by my mother. There were stars on the ceiling. There was an Aztec room which had Egyptian graffiti and mystical Eastern signs on it. And in the Casbah itself, the actual coffee bar part of it, there were tables, everything was wooden clad on the walls, which was totally a new innovation at that time. So it was a very comfortable, very cosy, very challenging place for the kids to relax and enjoy themselves.
Now, how did you meet John, Paul and George?
That came about because once my mother decided that the club was going to open, which was August the 29th, 1959, the band which should have opened it, the Les Stewart Quartet, broke up a couple of weeks before the club was due to open. And Ken Brown and George Harrison, who were founder members of that band, came down and actually saw my mother and explained the position to them. And she was left in a little bit of a quandary, simply because of the fact that 2 weeks to go to opening night, no band, and in a bit of a mess. So basically George turned around and said, Mona, I happen to know a couple of guys who I used to play with, and they might be interested in the job simply because of the fact it's a residency and they're not doing anything at the present moment. And, you know, I'll bring them down. So my mother basically turned around and said, bring them down the next day. They did, and lo and behold, it turned out to be John Lennon and Paul McCartney. And my mother put the deal to them. They were going to play for £3 a night, not each, but, you know, in total. And I suppose if you transcribe that into American dollars at the present moment, it's about $6 or something like that. And they agreed to it. And the last thing that she asked them was, what are you going to call yourselves? Because they didn't have a drummer. It was just John, George, Paul and Ken Brown. And John basically turned around and very casually turned around and said, well, we used to be the Quarrymen, so how does that sound to you, Mo? And Quarrymen it was. That's how they actually played at the Casbah and opened the Casbah a couple of weeks later.
How do they sound? What did they play?
They were, I suppose you could turn around and say, very similar to like a lot of other bands. But the incredible thing about it was the music they were doing was a little bit different. They sounded, you know, a little bit weak without the drummer, but they made up for it. With the harmonies and the choice of material, and plus the fact they had a lot of, you know, personality, which was cutting through, and the banter with the audience was incredible. And as I stood in the audience that particular night on opening night and watched, I just felt that there was something, you know, there was a spark of a diamond in there.
So how did you get to play with them? How did you get to be the drummer?
Well, I suppose that takes you very quickly up to August 1960, and I got a phone call from Paul. By this time, Stu Suckelford joined the band, and the drummer Tommy Moore had backed them on a tour of Scotland when they backed Johnny Gentle, another lad from Liverpool. And at the end of this particular tour, it wasn't the tours that the world knows the Beatles today. In fact, it was a bit of a disaster. And when they came back from this particular tour, Tommy Moore basically turned around and said, no, I've finished. You know, I don't want anything more to do with you. By this time, the name was the Silver Beatles. And Paul remembered that I was playing drums. And when the offer came up to basically go to Germany, I got a phone call from Paul McCartney. And he basically turned around and said, we've had the offer to go to Germany, Pete. We've seen you playing drums. You know, how about it? So I turned around and said, well, let me check it over with my own boys first. And they basically turned around and said, well, look, you know, we don't want to be professional. So go with our blessings. So the next thing you do is you check it out with your mum and dad. They said, if it's what you want to do, son, go with our blessings. So it was a phone call back to Paul again. And basically, yes, you know, I'll take the job. And he said, well, okay, you know, that's not a problem. We're glad that you've accepted, but you've got to come down and audition. So I went down the following day after throwing my drums in a taxi, went to the Wyvern Club, which later became the famous Blue Angel Club, and blasted off about six numbers, just standard numbers, which, you know, everyone was playing in those days. And after the audition, which lasted about 10, 15 minutes, they went away in a corner, had a little bit of a chat, and then came back and turned around and said, Pete, you're in.
Now, you were with the Beatles on their first German tour in 1960.
Mm-hmm.
What was that tour like?
It was a challenge. You've got to remember, we were, what, 17, 18-year-olds. We were supposed to be going out to Hamburg for a month, and we ended up being over there nearly close to 4 months. And, of course, when we went out there, we had no idea that we were going to be playing in Hamburg, which was the St. Pauli area of Hamburg, which was the red light entertainment district of the world at that time. And it was a challenge to us because when we got there, we knew that Hamburg and Liverpool were ports, but there was nothing as erotic as this particular area. The clubs were great. I mean, it was wonderful from that point of view. It was an exciting place. The daunting thing was that when we actually got there, we were told that we would have to go to play six, seven nights a week. And that was where the challenge came in. But we quickly mastered ourselves to it. It was an exciting time. You know, there was lots of wine. There was lots of women. Hard work. We played hard on stage and we played hard off stage as well.
I know Paul McCartney has said that being around strippers for the first time in Hamburg was, as he put it, eye-opening. Was it eye-opening for you?
I think it was. You've got to remember, as I mentioned before, we were 17, 18-year-olds in the environment we were in, you know. We'd heard about strippers, but actually being able to walk into a club or, you know, going down the Herbertstrasse or actually seeing them sitting in the shop windows there, you know, showing the goods and wares. And slightly different environment, you know, but great to be part of. We enjoyed ourselves.
Different from your mother's coffee club in the basement.
I would hope so. I would hope so, yeah.
Now, you said you had to play like 6-7 hours a night. That's a really long time. Did you end up playing songs that you otherwise never would have played, but you just needed a lot of material?
I think initially we did. But once we'd established ourselves, we found that a lot of the 6-7 hours a night were requests from people. You know, audiences drifted in, you know, different sessions. You had what we'd call the early audience, the mid audience, the late audience, and the people who stayed all the way through. So a lot of it was requests from the audience. They wanted to hear numbers. So, yes, you know, we would repeat numbers quite consistently. Some of the new material we picked up from the jukeboxes and, you know, improvised on material which we thought may go down well with the German audiences once we got accustomed to, you know, what they liked and what they disliked.
How did the band's look change when you got to Hamburg?
Oh, very much so. Initially when we went out, I think the outfits that we had were lilac jackets, black pants, black shirts, winkle pickers, as we would call them in those days, which were great crocodile pointed shoes, and black ties. Very quickly, after playing 6-7 hours a night, we suddenly found that the stage jackets and stage pants were, you know, sweating and disintegrating very, very quickly. And that we found that, you know, leather was easy to obtain, and we started to wear stuff on stage, which we could wear on stage as well as off stage, and it was economical to wear it and live in it, basically.
Was leather very rebel without a cause? Was it very like Marlon Brando or something? Did it seem like really cool, or was it just practical?
Well, it was cool and practical to us. I mean, okay, you know, we'd seen the Marlon Brandos, and of course we idolized Gene Vincent, you know, with his, you know, his leather suits and everything like this. But it was, I suppose, in Liverpool, unless you were a biker, you know, you didn't wear a leather jacket. But the style of leather jackets that were in Germany, we found were to our liking. You know, they weren't motorcycle jackets, and it was great. You know, we had bomber jackets and jeans and polo neck sweaters, and the image was gone, and we didn't bother to get our hair cut. So we were adapting ourselves to the image that we thought was, you know, great for ourselves, you know, as rock and rollers, as we called ourselves in those days.
My guest is Pete Best, the Beatles drummer who preceded Ringo Starr. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Pete Best, and he was the drummer with the Beatles before Ringo, and he has a new book called The Beatles, The True Beginnings. I think it was in 1961 when you were playing in Hamburg the second time around that the band teamed up with the singer Tony Sheridan, who you ended up recording with. And before we hear some of that music, tell us who Tony Sheridan was and how you teamed up with him.
Well, Tony Sheridan, on our first trip to Hamburg, we found that Tony Sheridan was playing at the Top Ten Club, where we ended up on our second trip. And at that time, he was the house musician, which was, I suppose you could turn around and say, the guy who was playing with any band which came through and played at the Top Ten. We'd seen Tony on television, on Old Boy, and of course, you know, when we found out that he was playing round the corner from where we were initially playing, it was like, whoa, we're going to see a star. It was great because we liked the way Tony played. We liked the way he sang, you know, and it was great to be part of it. You know, he was a household name back in England, and I suppose we had the opportunity of playing with him.
Well, let's hear some of the music that you recorded in 1961 with Tony Sheridan. So why don't we start with My Bonnie? And this is one that ended up being commercially released. I think of it as an old children's song. My Bonnie Lies Over the Ocean. How did you end up doing this?
Again, through the German audiences, basically. It was a number which Tony used to do initially with a German intro. And, of course, we adopted that to an English introduction when the song was actually recorded as well. But it was one of those numbers. You know, it was a folk song. The German people knew the folk song, even though they, you know, they sang it in German. And it was very much a case, it was adapted, we put a rock beat behind it, and it worked well with the German audiences.
Okay, well, let's hear it. This is My Bonnie. Tony Sheridan is singing, and backing him is the Beatles with my guest Pete Best on drums.
My Bonnie lies over the ocean.
My Bonnie, recorded in 1961, Tony Sheridan singing, the Beatles backing him up, with my guest Pete Best on drums, and he has a new book called The Beatles, The True Beginnings. That record that we just heard got commercially released. What was the result of that release? What kind of impact did it have on the career of the Beatles?
Well, I suppose the impact they had in Germany was not an awful lot, to be quite honest. When we came back home again, we could launch ourselves as Polydor Recording Stars with the record out. So it was, you know, we baited the interest of the kids in Liverpool. You know, this was a band, this was the Beatles. We were back home again, we had a record out, and it was called My Bonnie, even though the initial release turned around and said it was the Beat Brothers, you know, Tony Sheridan and the Beat Brothers. But it stimulated interest, and I think it's because of that, you know, that Brian Epstein became very curious as regards who the Beatles were.
Do you remember your first meeting with Brian Epstein?
Yes, we do, actually. It was, I suppose you could turn around and say, very informal. We were unaware of the fact that Brian had come down to watch us at the Cavern. But he'd watched us, he'd made a few inquiries, he realised, you know, who the Beatles were, and things must have been going through his mind. So word was passed to us after we'd played a dinner time session, which meant that we were playing for the public between 12 and 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, for the office workers and kids off school. And the message was passed to us, and very informally, basically, turned around and said, I would like to see you in my office around about 2:30, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, which fitted in with our timing perfectly. So we had a couple of pints and the grapes, and then off we trundled to meet Brian Epstein. And we met him in NEMS. And there he was in his formal attire of, you know, pinstripe suit, white shirt, polished shoes, you know, very clinical and clerical, but looking, you know, $1 million. And that was when he basically talked the deal around a little bit and said, it's a no-strings-a-deal attached. I've always wanted to manage a rock band. You know, I might be able to help you, but, you know, the bottom line is there's no strings attached. If it doesn't work out, then you go your way and I'll go my way. And they gave us a bit of time to think it over. And we did, and we went back, and I talked it over with my parents, and we talked it over amongst ourselves. And I suppose you could turn around and say that, you know, the overall opinion was that, yes, he should be manager. And that's how Brian became our manager.
And how did he change the band's image? Were you still wearing the leathers that you'd been wearing in Hamburg?
Well, it took a bit of time and a lot of persuasion from John and I, but we finally succumbed. Yeah, we went from the leathers and the cowboy boots and the leather pants and the long hair, basically into suits, which wasn't too happy. But we agreed to it simply because of the fact that it seemed a natural thing to do. It was an idea that he wanted to try. And it was very much a case of, okay, we'll go along with the idea, but let's make a 50-50 decision on it. You know, let's come to a resolution that we can both work on. And basically what it was, we agreed to go into suits. John and I very much under duress, but we hung on for our bargaining powers. And our bargaining powers were basically, okay, some nights we would wear our leathers, some nights we would wear our suits. On some bills we would wear leather and suits. So it was a compromise, basically, but we eventually agreed to it.
What kind of suit was it originally?
The original ones were navy blue mohair, Italian style, which we wore with white shirts and black ties, and, of course, you know, the famous Beetle boots.
Right. Well, you did a couple of auditions with Brian Epstein in the hopes of getting a recoding contract. The first was for Decca Records, and that was mm-hmm. in early January of 1962. Why don't we hear one of the originals? This is called Like Dreamers Do, and Paul McCartney sings lead on this. It's really interesting to hear him sing, because aside from a couple of places, it sounds like a pretty different style than the one he became known for. What do you think?
Well, I mean, Paul had a hell of a range, and he could deliver most songs. And, it would, you know, I suppose with it being an original number, he wanted it to be delivered the way he felt it should be. And it is different, but it's very contagious, you know, the way he delivers it. It's a semi, I suppose you could turn around and say semi-rock ballad, if there is such a thing. But it's a good song, and it was very catchy, and it caught on with the audiences all over the world.
Okay, well, let's hear Like Dreamers Do, recorded in 1962, featuring the Beatles with my guest, Pete Best, on drums.
I saw a girl in my dreams, and so it seems that I will love her. So it seems that I will love you, and I waiting for your kiss, waiting for the bliss, like dreamers do. And
Pete Best will be back in the second half of the show. His new book is called The Beatles, The True Beginnings. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
You, oh, I knew when you first said hello. That's how I know that I will love you. And I waited for your kiss, waited for the bliss.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of The Stones of Summer, the novel that inspired the film Stone Reader. Available October 22nd at Barnes & Noble stores and online at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And by Anchor Books, publishers of the new paperback by Thomas L. Friedman, Longitudes and Attitudes, The World in the Age of Terrorism. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Pete Best tells us how he was forced out of the Beatles and replaced by Ringo Starr. Also, book critic Maureen Carrigan reviews Against Love, A Polemic by Laura Kipnis. It's a witty critique of marriage and monogamy. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Pete Best, the drummer who preceded Ringo Starr and the Beatles. He played with the band from 1960 to 62. He and his brothers, Rogue and Rory Best, have written a new book called The Beatles, The True Beginnings, which also tells the story of the Casbah Coffee Club, the club that their mother, Mona, created in their basement in 1959 to give the neighborhood bands a place to play. When we left off, we were talking about the Beatles' first audition for a recording contract. Shortly thereafter, you did another audition for EMI Records.
Yeah.
And on this, you recorded four tracks, Besame Mucho, Love Me Do, P.S. I Love You, and Ask Me Why. There are recordings of Besame Mucho and Love Me Do included on the Beatles anthology. Was there a different strategy or a different sound or something you were going for on this audition since the other one didn't get you the recording contract?
I don't think so. I mean, I think we basically felt choice of material may have been a little bit wrong. Plus the fact we weren't playing at our best. And I think that was the main thing. So this time, we were very adamant that the material we wanted to do had to be right. I suppose we wanted to impress again. Having learnt our lesson the first time, we weren't as arrogant when we went back and, you know, realised that we'd got the recording contract. And George Martin had sent material down, which we weren't happy with. We felt that we could write better material, we could arrange better material. And consequently, that's when you get Besame Mucho, which was a commercial number, plus Love Me Do and P.S. I Love You, which were the numbers that we really wanted to record.
Let's start with Besame Mucho, because I think it shows off your drumming really well.
Well, it was one of those numbers, you know, everyone put their own arrangement to it. And then, you know, I suppose initially it is an old Latin American number, you know, very schmaltzy, depending which way you play it. And I just felt that the, you know, the drum pattern and the tom-tom added to, you know, what we needed.
Okay, so here's the Beatles with my guest Pete Best on drums from a 1962 audition recording. Cha-cha-boom! Bésame, bésame mucho. Each time I cling to your kiss, I hear music divine. So bésame, bésame mucho. I'll love you forever, say that you'll always be mine. Cha-cha-boom! Dearest one, if you should leave me, then each little dream will take wings and my life will be through. Oh, besame, besame mucho. Oh, love me forever, make all my dreams come true. Oh, this joy is something new, my arms are folding you. Never knew this thrill before. Spring, it's you I adore. Yes, so dearest one. The Beatles in 1962, my guest Pete Best on drums, and he has a new book called The Beatles, The True Beginnings. I just want to get in another song from this session, and this is Love Me Do. I guess it's probably, what, the first time you recorded Love Me Do?
It was, actually, yes. We'd played it many, many times. We improvised it in Germany, and that was when we first heard that we got the recording contract and Brian Epstein. And I'm talking now about April 62 when we opened the Star Club. It was very much a case of Brian telegraphed us and turned around and said, congratulations, you got the recording contract, start rehearsing your own material. And that was when we tried that out on the German audiences. We tried different formats. We tried a guitar lick in there, as opposed to the world-famous harmonica, which, you know, the world knows today. We weren't happy with that. The arrangement, we changed that around a little bit. Then we introduced the harmonica into it because we wanted to make it a little bit more haunting. And there was a change of beat in there because what was happening in those days, change of drum pattern in a number was very commercial. You didn't hear it too many times. So consequently, here on my particular version, which was the one that we played to the audiences of, in Germany and Liverpool prior to the recording, has a change of beat in it. And it was, you know, they liked that change of beat, and we thought that it worked well.
On this audition version of Love Me Do, it's slower than the version that was actually released, and the harmonies are a little off. It's not very polished sounding.
Well, it wasn't. You've got to remember that wasn't a finished, you know, it wasn't
exactly
meant to be finished.
Yeah.
It was supposed to, you know, go back. It was just to give George Martin an idea of the type of material that we could write. The whole essence of it, that we were supposed to go back and put the finishing touches to it. So what, you know, the people hear, it's a slower version. It's a little bit more country orientated. If you listen to the harmonica, it's a little bit more haunting. And I think there's a little bit of sorrow in it because we were reflecting the fact that Stu, you know, had died a couple of days beforehand. We were still under that particular, you know, tragedy. That was still hanging over us. And I think it was reflected in the music as well.
Okay, here's the Beatles recorded in 1962 with my guest Pete Best on drums. Love me do.
love me do, love me do.
We'll talk more with Pete Best about the early days of the Beatles after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Pete Best, the Beatles drummer who preceded Ringo Starr. He's written a new book with his brothers Rogue and Rory Best called The Beatles, The True Beginnings. Now, I want to read something that comes from a more painful part of your career with the Beatles. And this is George Martin, who produced the Beatles. In his memoir, All You Need Is Ears, he writes about you. And I just want to read that paragraph. This is George Martin's description of his first meeting with the Beatles. He writes, I remember George Harrison being the most talkative at that first meeting, and Pete Best not saying a word throughout the whole afternoon. But he did have the advantage of being the handsomest of the group, very sullen and rather like James Dean. His drumming, on the other hand, was not good. At the end of the test, I took Brian Epstein, to one side and said, I don't know what you're going to do with the group as such, but this drumming isn't good enough for what I want. It isn't regular enough. It doesn't give the right kind of sound. If we do make a record, I'd much prefer to have my own drummer, which won't make any difference to you because no one will know who's on the record anyway. What I didn't realize at the time was that the group already wanted Pete Best out and Ringo Starr in, and that my remarks were something in the nature of a last straw. Did you know at that time, and did you agree with us that the Beatles knew that they wanted you out at that time?
I wish I could answer that one, Terry. I know what George Martin turns around and says is correct, because he gave us the same answer. You know, when we questioned him as regards what had gone on behind the scenes, thinking that he may have been totally instrumental in the dismissal. But what had gone on before that? I mean, there was no forewarning, you know, whether they wanted Ringo in. There was no mention of it. So anything which I suppose was happening was kept away from me. And, you know, not being aware of it, you were left in the position you didn't know what the hell was going on.
How did George Martin... Was it George Martin who asked you to leave?
No. I mean, it was basically, as I suppose George Martin turns around and says, over the years, you know, I mean, let's be quite honest, he has recorded for the Beatles, he is Sir George Martin. Now, if he said something which was totally different from what had been mentioned many, many years ago, then, you know, it's going to destroy Beatles myths and, you know, the whole of the Beatles history. But from my way of thinking, if you look at it from my point of view, I was, let's put it this way, displaced by Ringo Starr. George Martin was unaware of the fact that I was replaced. He was told that I had left the band. And this is information that we got from him after we contacted him. And it was very much a case, he didn't realise that, you know, Ringo had joined the band, he was expecting Pete to be back again. When Ringo came down, he was introduced as the new drummer. He listened to Ringo, and he still had the same idea. You know, it was very much a case the following week, Andy White was brought in, and hence Andy White on the initial recordings of Love Me Do and P.S. I Love You was the drummer, even though Ringo did record them as well. So there is a lot of controversy there. But as I turn around and say, it's something which I leave, you know, to people's imagination. They can sort it out. A lot of people have turned around and said, you know, and as I've always turned around and said, George Martin at that time wasn't into rock drumming. Most probably didn't realise what a change of beat was, didn't realise what we were trying to do on the record. And just to, you know, make a pertinent point, as he turns around and says, and, you know, a lot of other people have turned around and said it as well, you know, I did speak that afternoon. You know, I am not a silent mute. I do have an opinion. I do voice my opinions, you know, but I keep it to myself. I was as laughing and joking as the rest of them.
Boy, listening to you talk, I keep thinking it must be so strange to have such a significant event in your life be the subject of rock lore. And so, like, everybody knows the story, whether it's true or not. Everybody thinks they know the story, but it actually happened to you, and it was, I'm sure, very painful when it did happen.
Well, it's one of those things. I mean, you know, everyone knows the story or thinks they know the story. All you can do is put your, you know, particular perspective of it. And at the end of the day, I leave it up to people's, you know, their own decision. You know, they are the ones to make the decision, you know, whether Ringo's a better drummer than me, whether I fitted into the band, whether I was antisocial. Everyone has their own opinion. There's most probably two or three people alive today who know the definitive reason. Now, if it ever comes out before we ever leave this planet, then fine, you know. But to me, as it stands at this present moment in time, it doesn't really worry me, to be quite honest. You know, I've lived my life without knowing the definitive reason. I most probably lived the rest of it without knowing the definitive reason. And it may be one of these occasions where it becomes the, you know, the same as the, you know, the mystery of the pharaohs. It might or become one of the enigmas of rock and roll history. I don't know. And at this present moment in time, it really doesn't worry me too much. I'm enjoying myself, and I've got a lot of things which I'm compensating myself for.
So was it Brian Epstein who actually told you you were out?
It was, yeah. I mean, but I suppose in hindsight, when you look at it, and from what I've heard, and it was very much a case of the boys weren't at the dismissal, and by the boys, I mean John, George and Paul. Brian was the manager, and it was very much a case of, Brian, you're the manager. You are the one who is going to tell Pete that he's out the band.
And I've read you haven't spoken to the Beatles since that day. Is that true?
That's quite true, yes. It's, you know, a lot of people turn around and say that there must be animosity, you know, the fact that no one's picked the phone up and, you know, contacted one another or tried to, you know, resolve our differences. At the end of the day, there's no differences as far as I'm concerned. The door's always been open, you know. Picking the phone up, a lot of people don't realise how difficult that is in this particular business. What they've got to realise is the fact that the Beatles were very quickly, after my dismissal, well on the way to becoming the icons in the music industry. And, you know, the Beatle Empire, the NEMS Empire, which later became the Apple organisation, was vastly growing and quickly growing. And it didn't matter who you were. Unless they wanted to speak to you, you wouldn't get through to them. Consequently, knowing this and, you know, the futility of trying to resolve it, you know, you concentrate and persevere with your own career, and consequently, as a result of that, you know, your lives draw apart. But life is, you know, plays funny tricks, and, you know, maybe it's karma, maybe the tapestry, I don't know, but I have a strange feeling that Paul and I will meet up again one of these days.
What was it like for you to watch the Beatles become the most famous band in the world? And you had been with them and weren't any longer.
Interesting, if I could put it that way, and mystifying as well. I suppose the heartache came when the first record, Love Me Do, went into the charts. The mercurial rise and the, you know, watching them become the, you know, the biggest phenomenon in the music industry was something which I don't think anyone expected. So that was like total fantasy. But the heartache for me was initially, you know, with Love Me Do, because that was the belief that we had in the band that we could break through into the English charts. And lo and behold, with their first record, you know, the first release on a major English label, you know, that was the success we'd believed in. So the rest of it, you know, was a little bit pipe dream.
What have you done for a living over the years?
Rock musician for 8 years, up till 1968. And then I worked in a bakery for 12 months, slicing bread and loading wagons. And then I had the offer to join the civil service in England. And I stayed with them for about 20 years. Worked my way through the normal promotional channels. Started off finding people jobs and ended up as training manager for the northwest of England, rehabilitating people and setting programs up for them. And then in 1988, I did a one-off show in Liverpool, which I thought was going to be a total one-off show, which meant that I was getting back on stage again and playing drums. And lo and behold, that was the turning point for me to go back into music again. And consequently, as a result of that, I've reformed the Pete Best Band and we're touring the world and doing all the silly things which musicians do at the present moment.
So you're still living in Liverpool?
I'm still in Liverpool, yeah.
And do you live in the place that the Casbah was in the basement?
I used to for many, many years. I don't now. But what we have there now is that the Casbah is still there. It will be resurrected from the ashes next year. It will go back on the tourist trail and it will be reopened to the public again. But we have our offices there and we have a recording studio which has been built on the next floor above it. So, you know, that is our workplace. You know, Heyman's Green has now become the workplace for us.
Now, I have to ask you something about your mother. Your mother grew up in India. Her father mm-hmm. was in the British Army and was stationed in India. When mm-hmm. she met your father, who was from Liverpool, they met in India and then moved to Liverpool.
Yeah.
And your mother loved singing, and I guess at some point she even considered being a singer. So mm-hmm. when she opened up the club in the basement of your house, and all of these like great Merseybeat bands were playing there, and what was it like to have a mother who was like so hip and so in tune with this music that you loved, with music that was considered very rebellious by most parents, but your mother, she was opening up a club for performing it.
It was great. I mean, it was wonderful to have a mother who was thinking that way. I mean, she was younger heart. She realized what the kids wanted. She was different. Even Paul turned around and said, you know, there aren't many women in the world like Mo, you know, as she affectionately used to be known as. She hated being called Mrs. Best. It was always Mo or Mona. And I suppose it's true. And that rubbed off on people. She was so charismatic. She was forthright. It was a challenge to her. She enjoyed music. It was a privilege for her to actually accommodate young children and, given this platform to actually have live music played in the basement of her home. And she enjoyed the fact that, you know, it was being played in such a fashion that it was, this music which was going to change the world many, many years afterwards.
John Lennon certainly had a lot of issues with his mother. What was his reaction to your mother?
He loved her. I mean, it was great because I suppose in the early days, when John and I used to come back to the Casbah and we'd raid the fridge and, you know, the crisps and the chips and all the other bits and pieces and, you know, hide away upstairs in the sitting room and play records till about 4 o'clock in the morning. It was one of those things. He loved the informality and plus the fact that you've got to remember because at that time Mo used to talk to them and she was quite open, you know, and she basically showed John some medals of her grandfathers. And, of course, when Sergeant Pepper was being put together many, many years afterwards, John remembered that. And he came back and, you know, asked Mona if he could borrow those medals. And, you know, we're very proud of the fact that he was actually wearing them on Sergeant Pepper. And the only condition that she gave to him was that basically, John, yes, you can have the medals, but make sure, you know, you do return them to me. They were my father's, and I'm very proud of those. And consequently, as a result of that, he did, you know. So, I think he loved Mona deep down inside.
Well, Pete Best, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure, believe you me.
Pete Best's new book is called The Beatles, The True Beginnings. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews a new book that makes the case against marriage and monogamy. This is Fresh Air. Although our book critic Maureen Corrigan has words of praise for the book she's about to review, you may not want to give this book to your spouse or lover. It's called Against Love, A Polemic.
Do not bring this book along on family get-togethers. Do not bring it up at dinner parties, picnics, or soccer games where other coupled adults congregate. Quoting chunks of Laura Kipnis's new nonfiction book, Against Love, to a crowd of married grown-ups will provoke general laughter and knowing nods, followed by a round of hurt glances, sputtering defenses, and gloomy silences. This book is trouble. Only adulterers, free lovers, and sexually blithe singletons will feel reassured after reading it. And the worst thing is, Kipnis is so convincing. Against Love is a vastly entertaining and smart work of social criticism that wonders aloud about whether there could be forms of daily life based upon something other than isolated households and sexually exclusive couples. She subtitles her book A Polemic, which is an over-the-top form of argumentation most famously employed in Jonathan Swift's essay, A Modest Proposal. That's the one where Swift suggests that the logical solution to the Irish famines of the 18th century would be cannibalism. The power of a polemic rests chiefly on a writer's gift for language, especially for metaphor. Kipnis demonstrates her brilliance at the form when she opens by describing the married libido this way. Once a well-known freedom fighter, now a sorry, shriveled thing, from swaggering outlaw to model citizen, Janis Joplin to Barry Manilow in just a few short decades, all applicable organs pledged to the couple as community property. Throughout Against Love, Kipnis plays the part of a heretic in the chapel of love, citing the well-known statistic that 50% of American marriages fail, and nodding to the reality that hordes of married men and women stray. She considers why Americans clearly harbor ambivalence and anxiety about monogamy, a way of life we're all supposed to regard as natural. In this light, she interprets the 1990s ruckus over philandering politicians, everybody from Newt Gingrich to Bill Clinton, as a kind of subconscious strategy the nation adopted to act out its collective conflicts over marriage. A running question throughout the book is this zinger: is boredom socially necessary? According to Kipnis, marriage and its attendant boredoms serve the same purpose that religion does in Marx's analysis. It's an opiate of the people. Coupled and settled down, the married masses are less likely to protest in the streets or be insubordinate on the job. Kipnis is especially sharp at pointing out how the rhetoric of the factory has permeated our conversations about romance, citing in particular the contemporary cliché about working on relationships. No one works at adultery, she notes, as she goes on to catalog all the enforcement mechanisms required to keep legally co-joined citizens from wandering out of what she calls their domestic gulags. There's the booming business of therapy, and then in the private sphere, there's what Kipnis calls the favorite recreational pastime of coupledom, mate behavior modification. If you really want to spark a rip-roaring conversation with your spouse or spousal equivalent, try setting aside a night to read through Kipnis's 9-page list of all the things you can't do because you're in a couple. Among them, you can't leave the house without saying where you're going, and you can't be less concerned with the other person's vulnerability than with expressing your own opinions. Kipnis's chilling verdict at the end of this list is that virtually no aspect of everyday life is not subject to regulation and review, and in modern love, acceding to a mate's commands is what constitutes intimacy. Because Kipnis covers her back by reminding readers that the job of a polemic is to poke holes in cultural pieties, not to tell both sides of an issue, she doesn't offer objections or solutions to the flat vision of nuptial numbness she summons up. Against Love is such an unsettling and witty deconstruction of marriage and monogamy, it will leave a lot of readers grasping for a comeback. Ideally, something more engaging than the paranoid political rhetoric of the Defense of Marriage Act.
Maureen Carrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Against Love, a polemic by Laura Kipnis. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Schurach. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, political satirist Al Franken. His new book became an immediate bestseller when Fox News sued over its title, Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them, A Fair and Balanced Look at the Right. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.